Your ongoing financial support for this public radio station makes all the difference in your community. Thanks again for doing what you can to make public radio a vibrant part of the landscape where you live. And public radio gives us insights into lands where we don't live. If you've ever been on YouTube, there's a good chance you've seen the viral video called Gangnam Style.
Open Gangnam Style.
It's by a Korean pop music star named Psy. It turns out that this video is part of a much larger movement. Korean pop culture of all kinds is spreading to eager audiences all around the world. According to Yoon Hee-hong, author of the book Korean Cool, the increasing popularity of Korean pop culture is the result of a carefully planned and well-funded initiative by the Korean government. And whether you realize it or not, you're probably being schooled in the culture of Korean Cool.
Korean Cool encompasses food, film, fashion, television dramas, K-pop songs, and even things like breakdancing. It's the entire package that Korea is using to present itself to the world in an attempt to create a national PR campaign. And the end goal is not necessarily to have all these viral videos of K-pop songs, although that's obviously great. The end goal is to create an image of Korean cool, which, like American cool of the 20th century, Korean cool of the 21st century is meant to ensure that people buy Korean products long past the time that they've forgotten about Psy, long past the popularity of Korean pop music or Korean dramas. It's about a national branding campaign.
So it really is branding. I was going to say it's about building a brand, and you've got from buy a car, buy a mobile phone, buy whatever. If it's Korean, it's cool, and that's worth a lot of money outside of silly pop culture. So this is sort of a marketing campaign.
First of all, no non-English-speaking country has ever attempted to compete with the United States in the pop culture wars. Korea is a country of something like 60, 70 million people, and it speaks a language that is not spoken outside its borders. So not only are they the first country to attempt this, they're also the first country to demonstrate that cool can actually be manufactured with effort and money, which is sort of the opposite of what we normally think of as being cool, as effortless.
That's right. It's a calculated and invested cool. Is it mostly done in English language, would you say?
This is one of the interesting things about it, is that they've kept very faithful to keeping, well, the dramas are certainly all in Korean. The pop songs are in Korean, but with English refrains and choruses, you know, a lot of the yeah, baby kind of thing. And that's always in English. That's kind of just an homage to the genre. But yeah, what's interesting is that they have kept it in Korean, and there has not been any demand really for that to change, except I would say in the world of cinema, which requires a whole nother level of financing.
When we think of the impact of this movement of Korean cool and so on, is the impact in the Pacific Rim greater than we realize because we're farther away here in the United States?
Absolutely. Korea is basically the Marlboro Man of Asia. Particularly Southeast Asia, Thailand, Taiwan, Hong Kong, or even mainland China or Japan. You know, you see posters on the walls of major Japanese products that are, and they're being advertised by Korean stars. And I'll give you a specific example. In Thailand, there was a TV ad that ran last year for Lipton iced tea. And the premise of the ad is that a Thai guy is trying to impress a girl, you know, without success, then he drinks the iced tea, and Lipton iced tea makes him cool suddenly. And how does he show this? He suddenly can speak Korean.
Wow.
This is completely out of context. It has nothing to do with the setting. It has nothing to do with Lipton iced tea. It's just sort of like, I don't know, the American equivalent would be a guy who can suddenly speak French, or I don't even know. And it works.
A lot of us, the only thing we know about Korean cool is the Gangnam Style video. When you look at that video, is that a sort of a typical representation of what all this cool is about, the music and the fashion? Does that sort of sum it up in a kind of an honest way or a straight way?
Well, the Gangnam video was the exception that proves the rule. Psy is not the ambassador that Korea wanted to put the face of Korean pop music on the map. He was very much an outlier in many ways. One, he did not rise through the K-pop factory system. He's a little bit too old. He's the wrong body type. He has never had cosmetic surgery. And he's a singer-songwriter, which, believe it or not, is extremely rare in the world of K-pop. Usually the bands are prefabricated and the songs are written by somebody else, and Psy did everything himself. And so, I mean, he was very famous in Korea, but sort of as this kind of embarrassment, you know, not taken seriously at all. And when I saw his video, people obviously kept sending this to me because I grew up in Gangnam, actually, which is the area of Seoul that Gangnam Style is about. And I was a little bit embarrassed by it. I think a lot of Koreans were.
It's kind of the Beverly Hills of Seoul, isn't it? A district called Gangnam.
Not only is it the Beverly Hills of Seoul, but there is a shopping street called Rodeo Drive.
Okay, there you go.
So, yes.
It's fascinating. Now, visually, what is the visual cliche of Korean cool? What would we look at if you were in Thailand or Vietnam or Philippines and somebody was trying to be Korean cool? How would they look?
Aesthetically, for men, the look would just be extreme high fashion of the kind that in the West you haven't seen since David Bowie or, you know, or Elton John. You know, very loud colors, sort of tight tailored cuts, like sort of more of an Italian cut rather than
Italian,
a baggy.
Like
English.
Italian David Bowie.
Yes, Italian David Bowie, perfect. Like, yeah, exactly. If David Bowie were a Gucci model or something like that.
A little closer to home, maybe right down the street, there's something else that's pretty cool, although it's best served hot, with a side of pancakes. And it never goes out of style. I'm talking about the breakfast special at the diner or cafe where perhaps you and the locals in your town hang out in the morning. Michael Stern is the co-author with Jane Stern of the book and website Road Food. He spends his days traveling the American back roads in search of the best local specialties. And Michael's joined us recently to talk about his favorite regional breakfasts.
To us, it really is the most important meal of the day, not necessarily nutritionally, but because it's at breakfast where you really can feel where you are, take the pulse of a community, if you will. You know, dinner's fine, lunch is fine, but at breakfast, if you find the right place, breakfast restaurants are the type of places where townsfolk congregate, where truckers on their way to somewhere begin the day. It's a wonderful place, not only for eating well, but also for conversation. It's a very convivial meal in most places.
You know, I took a road trip on a lecture tour that went literally from Seattle to Tallahassee, crisscross, the longest way across the country. And as a standard operating procedure, every morning we would leave the bigger town and we would drive an hour and turn off the highway in a smaller town where we wouldn't really want to spend the night, but where you'd probably have more character. And I thought that was the greatest trick, is just to get an hour of driving under your belt and then have breakfast in a place that doesn't have a lot of glitz and tourism, but as you mentioned, where the town folk congregate. What would you look for to choose a place where you're going to have the most ambience that way?
The obvious thing, if you're traveling by car, is to look for a place where the vehicles around it have local license plates. And in certain parts of the country, you want to look for a place with a lot of pickup trucks around it. The other thing that I think is wise to look for is to have some sense, even before you're going, of what the local specialties are, because of all the different meals of the day, breakfast in some ways is the most distinctive, you know, region to region.
Let's talk about that for a minute. What would be the marquee differences from region to region that you'd look for on a road trip when it comes to breakfast?
For example, in the South, you're going to look for good old country ham and biscuits that are just angelically fluffy. In New England, crusty topped muffins are a real passion, and donuts too. I don't mean franchise chain donuts, but little donut shops that make wonderful donuts. In the heartland, throughout Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, you're going to find restaurants that specialize in big kind of kitchen sink scrambles, and huge cinnamon rolls are a big deal throughout Iowa.
Kitchen
in
sink
New Mexico.
Scrambles. Now, because I remember reading in your book about the horseshoe, and that's apparently just in Springfield, Illinois.
That's unique to Springfield, Illinois, and it's not quite a scramble. It's supposed, originally, the horseshoe was supposed to look like an anvil and a horseshoe and some shoeing nails, but in fact, what it's become is a great, gigantic pile of food.
On a piece of bread, right? It's like an open piece
of sandwich. There are a couple of pieces of toast at the very bottom. You don't see them because they're covered with French fries, eggs, sausage, cheese, gravy, and many other things.
So that's an example of something you need to know about when you're going through Illinois.
Exactly.
I interrupted your tour around the country. Then where else were you heading for regional specialties?
I was thinking of the Southwest. You know, there you have tremendous influence of Mexico. And And there you're going to find a dish on many menus throughout the Southwest called migas, M-I-G-A-S. And what that is, it's kind of a scrambled egg dish, but into which they throw little bits of tortilla.
Huh.
And what's great is that as it cooks, some of the pieces of tortilla get nice and soft and tender and just kind of like a vein of corn flavor. Other pieces stay or get really crisp on the griddle. So the texture of migas is really wonderful.
Michael, I feel almost dirty talking to you. This is just like, ooh, it's so nice.
It is. Migas is great. I just have to mention there's a place in Oklahoma City called the Klassen Grill where they make out of this world migas. And you can have sausage in it and eggs and whatever else you want.
You know, when you go to California, it's a little more trendy and healthy, it seems like.
Well, it can be. One of the unique specialties that you find in California and up the coast to Oregon and Washington is something called the New Joe Special or the Joe Special, which is a unique kind of omelet. It apparently dates back to the 1920s. It's not really an omelet. It's another egg scramble, but it always includes beef and spinach and maybe some cheese as well. But it's a wonderful sort of breakfast scramble that is also one of those great breakfasts that you can have if you need a good hearty meal at midnight.
I just had that this morning, believe it or not, Joe's Special. I split it because it's more than enough for me,
right. And
it is a great, I like it better than an omelet, and you can get the Joe's Special our way, which has spicy Italian sausage, which I like too.
Yeah, actually the place I was thinking of is a diner up in Spokane, Washington called Frank's, where they specialize they have a wonderful Joe Special, and on the side, one of those absolutely fundamental breakfast dishes, which is really good hash brown potatoes.
Oh, yeah. Looking through your book, one of the most enticing photographs was the photograph of triple berry toast on the Oregon coast. Describe that
for
us.
Well, okay, Oregon is a place where in season, which is, you know, kind of late summer, throughout the summer, but late summer in particular, the berries are just fresh, plump, bursting with flavor. Triple berry toast is homemade toast. It was at a place called the Green Salmon in Yahats, Oregon,
right
on the coast.
Nice town,
by the way, too. Beautiful town. A couple of pieces of, you know, of multigrain toast topped with mascarpone cheese, blueberries, raspberries, and strawberries, a drizzle of honey and a dash of powdered sugar. And the combination of those, of the cheese and the plump, fresh berries and the toast, it's divine.
I'm pretty sure I need to hunt down something like that tomorrow morning. I bet there's a local joint where you go for the best breakfast and conversation in town. And I bet this station that you're listening to right now plays a similar role in your day, filling you up with news and information, programming that's enlightening, inspiring, and convivial to boot. I value public radio, both as a producer and as a consumer, because this is the bright oasis on the dial that respects your intellect, assumes an attention span, and brings you programming driven not by a passion for keeping its advertisers happy, but by a passion for bringing you a better understanding of our world. With Travel with Rick Steves, I get to cook you up a plateful of good radio each week, using the best and smartest ingredients anywhere. As you enjoy this meal, I want to make sure you understand just how much the station relies on its listeners to keep feeding you the quality content you've come to rely on. That's why I'm asking you right now to contribute during this membership drive. This is not a charity, it's a service. If you're consuming it and can't afford to help out, that's fine. It's public radio, it's for all of us. But if you're consuming this and you can't afford to help out, it's only right to do so. Go ahead, give your station a call. You'll find it's actually fun to be part of the action right now during this special fundraising edition of Travel with Rick Steves. We're public radio, and we're counting on you.